Everyone faces questions and decisions that require insight and answers as we move forward personally, professionally, and corporately in all areas of this thing we call life in America today. Hello, this is Joe Schofield, and I invite you to tune in every Monday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. as we talk together and hear from key leaders of all ages and backgrounds about your questions. Interesting, informative, intuitive, but always encouraging. Tune us in on BBS Radio Network.
Join Pastor Joe and co-hosts Commander Rob Hansen, Nancy Hansen, and Dr. Paul Hall in Raising Expectations.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's edition of Raising Expectations. And we hope that's what this program will do for you. Help you to raise your expectation, be encouraged and be strengthened in all the things in your life. We are so blessed tonight to have with us such a special guest. But just before we start, in case this is your first time, we want you to meet our team of co-hosts because they're about the best you're going to find anywhere in the world. We have with us Dr. Paul Hall, theologian, pastor, great teacher, my friends for probably 50 years. That's a long time. And we have also Dr. Craig and Stephanie Thayer. Craig is a surgeon. Stephanie's a health and wellness coach. And like I say, she's going to put us in such good shape. Doug, we're going to be on the U.S. Olympic team next time around, all of us. She really does a good job. And also our friend Commander Rob and his wife. Rob had surgery today, so we've been praying for him. Everything went well. He was a Top Gun pilot and trainer with the United States Navy, as he says. So that's our team. We want you to be part of the family and feel right at home. We want you to know that we share, we talk, we uplift, we encourage, and that's the reason we're here. Now, let me share with you very quickly. We have tonight somebody that is so special. We're excited to be able to have Doug Weed. Now, Doug Weed has served with interviewed six different presidents in the United States of America. He served on the senior staff of President H.W. Bush. He is a New York Times best-selling author, over 30 different books. We're going to be talking about one here tonight. Fox News, Newsmax, C-SPAN, a news commentator. And the neat thing is, all of his years as a great American historian, he has incredible insights to share with us tonight on the political climate of our beloved nation, the United States of America, and the upcoming election. Doug's book, which is just incredible, is called Inside Trump's White House, the real story of his presidency. And as it says in the small print, written with unprecedented access to the president, his family, and his closest friend. Doug is a mentor to thousands of people, and he's also the president of Canyonville Christian Academy, an incredible school in Oregon that has a history of greatness in the lives of countless people, literally around the world. So I think I said all that as quick as I can. Doug, we welcome you to Raising Expectations. And again, sir, we're privileged on behalf of all of our staff on three. Let's welcome Doug Weed. We're glad you're with us tonight, sir. Doug, share a little bit about yourself, and then we're going to have some wonderful questions for you.
Joe, I just want to say I think your show is so important. There's so much censorship today. And any of you who are listening, who want to make an investment in your country and in freedom of speech, you ought to send a donation in here to keep this show going, because I've seen the list, the catalog. They've had some of the greatest leaders in the country on their show. I don't know how they do it, but I know they don't get big advertising dollars. So anybody that can send in something, that'd be great. I'm just happy to be here tonight. So you can just go start with any subject you want to talk about. I had unprecedented access to the president and his family, and I could ask any questions I wanted, and boy, I did.
Does anybody like to lead off with a question for Mr. Weed?
Sure, sure. I mean, six presidents and then Trump. How did you get their trust?
Boy, well, each president is totally different. It's totally a different story. So your show isn't long enough for me to describe all of it, but I had a great relationship with Gerald Ford and had him in my home in Missouri. And then again, when I lived in Arizona, had him in my home. He's a very interesting guy, very bright. The news media portrayed him as stupid, as dumb. He's in fact a policy wonk, or he was. He's gone now, but he was a policy wonk, so he could just talk circles around you on the given topic. And I was blown away by that. I believed, I guess, what I'd seen in the media. Imagine that. And here was this very bright, sharp mind. Who knew the policy backwards and forwards. And Reagan, I went to his home, he and Nancy Reagan in Pacific Palisades, the week that they announced for the presidency in 1979. And I was asked to write a book about the president, and he was then former governor. And I did. I wrote a book about Ronald Reagan. I got a hold of my agent in New York, and I said, hey, they've asked me to write Reagan's book. I've got this book. Well, what are we going to do? He said, I'll get right back to you. So he got back to me and he said, no publisher in New York will touch it. I said, what? What? They don't think he's going to make it through the Iowa caucus. I said, what? I think he's got a good chance to beat Ambassador Bush in the Iowa caucus. I think he's going to do good. And my agent said, no, you don't understand me. They don't think he's going to live through the Iowa caucus. He's too old. They don't think he'll ever be elected president of the United States. So it turned out that Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States, and my book was the only book available. There wasn't any other book. So it sold, and all those big shot writers in New York didn't have one ready. They didn't expect him to make it. And I met through him Vice President Bush, who became President George H.W. Bush, served him, and his son traveled with his son, George W., car caravans and Winnebagos and commercial jets and private jets, and traveled with him on the campaign, and then met the Trumps. Each one was a separate story.
I just want to direct a question at the book. The book's really incredible, Doug. It's not only factual, but just like with all the president's children, you bring the lives of people alive, just like you did at the Academy. You make everybody feel like we know these people. And I just kind of had a question. As you looked at those, who perhaps one or two, I think you mentioned Jared Kushner, was kind of the most interesting to you, and I know they were all uniquely different, but I love what you said. Maybe you could share just a word for everybody as we continue.
Yeah, I was surprised. First, I was blown away by Donald Trump. You see him, of course, in public, and you know he's an open book, and I could ask him anything, and he would tell me. I was really blown away by how honest he is, how frank he is, how hard he works. He wanted to do everything on day one, everything. He wanted to destroy ISIS on day one. He wanted to wrap up the Afghan war. He wanted to create all the jobs that we needed in this country. He wanted NATO to pay their fair share as they promised. Everything, all of it. He wanted to do it all on day one. But I found Jared Kushner to be very impressive and extremely sharp. The crib notes going in, Joe, were that Jared Kushner's liberal. He's Jewish. He and Ivanka are Jewish. And they emphasize the liberal side of things and are that influence to Donald Trump. That's not what I found. What I found is that Jared Kushner is the enabler. He can take on any assignment the president gives him. He's brilliant. And he will argue all sides of an issue. He wants to make sure that Donald Trump has heard both sides or all sides of a given issue before he makes up his mind. But once the president makes up his mind, he's right in there helping him make it happen. He's very loyal. That's why he's been there the whole time. So I think conservatives had it totally wrong. But he had so many interesting things to say. Russian collusion comes to mind. when they first began this whole idea of Russian collusion, the kids, the Trump kids, were traveling all over the world. And wherever they go, Jared told me that a head of state would pull them into their office and would have a private meeting with them. This is Don Jr., Eric, Laura, all of them as they're traveling around. And they would say, please tell your father when you get home that we're so sorry he's going through this Russian collusion nonsense. And Joe, when I heard that, it's like a bell going off. I thought, well, of course, if you're the prime minister of Great Britain or the president of France, if you're Benjamin Netanyahu, you can't wait 2 years for the Mueller investigation to find out if he's a Russian spy. The future of your country, its economy, its security, depends on dealing with the United States. You have to know. And someone like Benjamin Netanyahu would pick up the phone and call Mossad, the director of Mossad, and say, I saw this article in the New York Times. What is going on? I've known the Trumps all my life. I need to know by 6 p.m. tonight. What's going on? The whole world knew, the governments of the world knew that this was phony baloney. I mean, if Donald Trump was a Russian spy, it would be one of the greatest events of world history. It would be like landing a man on the moon. It would be like Christopher Columbus crossing the ocean. It would be like the assassination of Julius Caesar. It would be one of the most remarkable moments in all of history. The Russians, with $200,000 worth of Facebook ads, were able to figure out what the New York Times couldn't. And they groomed Donald Trump and got him elected. And then they had him throw us all off by having him modernize the nuclear deterrent, increase sanctions against Russia, give the Ukraine missiles that could destroy tanks. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing. So when I heard Jared describe what they were going through as children of the president, it drove home the point to me, and I realized, of course, the world knew. America wasn't told, but the world knew this is ridiculous.
Amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I put myself in people's shoes, and I imagine what it must be like to be Trump with all the fake news and all the media that's negative in a divided country. How does he, you saw him behind the scenes. How does he mentally survive that onslaught?
You know, of course, I asked him that as you would, and he had a couple of different responses because I asked him the same question several times, and his first response was, "I can take it. I think it would break most people. Most people," he said, "I think most presidents couldn't take it, but I can take it." And then another time he said, "What can I do? I can't do anything about it. I don't have any choice. It's sink or swim." So I can tell you, they know what's going on and they know the pain of what's going on. Think of Melania Trump. A New York Times reporter said that she had once been a prostitute and still has his job at the New York Times, was not fired from the New York Times. They had comedians on national television have people create the hashtag Trump incest. They've had some of the most terrible and outrageous attacks of anybody in public life ever. That's what they've gone through. But the kids told me an interesting story. They said that the president and first lady are very cute together. And they said sometimes at dinner time, they remembered one occasion where Melania was being hurt by the national media. Terrible things were being said about her for no other reason than just pure jealousy. Mm-hmm. And so she was kind of down. They were all having dinner and the president came in and he sat down with the family and he said, "Melania, honey, isn't this great? This advantage adventure I'm taking you on. If it weren't for me, you wouldn't be the First Lady of the United States. Aren't you glad I took you on this great adventure? Melania says, oh yeah, thanks very much. Thanks very much. So they suffer, but they have fun with it too. And they've had some pretty glorious moments. I describe in the book the moment when he and Melania were together, when they learned, when the Mueller investigation, their conclusion came through, and they've had some pretty wonderful moments together.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning the Trump children, and their youngest, Baron, it has the same birthday as one of our children. So I was taken aback by the attacks on him. And our son is also very tall like him. They have a lot of similarities. But to me, from the outside, the Trump family seems very tight and very connected. And I was wondering if you could just share, you've alluded to it a little bit, but your observations of that. It seems like they do things as a family. They don't sort of do it separately.
Yeah, that's true. Sounds like you've read my book.
If you haven't, but I want to.
Well, I got to get it to you because you would love the stories. You're right on the money. They color coordinate. They talk every day by text. All day long, they're talking to each other by text. So, for example, on a inauguration day, when they plan, I'm going to wear white, and well, I'm going to wear blue. Well, then I won't wear white. I'll wear, and they're back and forth, the ladies and the guys. And so they text to each other. I was amazed at how close they were and how under this tremendous pressure they didn't break apart. I mean, you stop and think of other families. I mean, I think, for example, FDR, he had 5 children. They had 19 marriages between them. Or you look at the Reagan children, or you look at, I mean, I could go on and on. So the Trumps are very tight, very, very close to each other. I can tell you an interesting story that's in the book. My stories are true, by the way, and they're from the actual source. They're not hearsay, and they're not from anonymous. They've got quotes. But the day of the inauguration, they were just exhausted. They were just worn out, and the women had to wear high heels, and the night before they had to go up the slippery marble steps of the Lincoln Memorial for that special musical. The next day, up the Capitol and then down the other side of the Capitol for the inauguration. And then they were in the caravan, the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue, and the cars stopped, as is the tradition. And the First Lady and the President and the family all got out, and they walked down Pennsylvania Avenue in their high heels, so the ladies. So that night, they're at the inaugural balls, and they're dancing all over the dance floors in high heels. And what nobody knew is that Lara was pregnant. So they get back to the White House that night, and the butlers of the White House have laid out food for the kids, hot dogs, hamburgers, and the adults are starved. So they all go into the state dining room and they devour the kids' food. Meanwhile, the grandkids are scurrying through the state floor, playing a rousing game of hide-go-seek with Baron, who was 10 years old at the time. And Baron hears this large exclamation from the state dining room. He comes running in. He's huffing and puffing because the other grandkids are all hiding. They want Uncle Baron. He's their favorite uncle, to find him. And he says, what? And they explain, well, Lara here just told us she's going to have a baby. So there's going to be another baby in the family. And Baron says, oh, okay. And then he's off. He's running, trying to find the kids who have found new hiding places in the East Room. So they're a typical family. And that night they finally get to sleep. But early in the morning, they've got one more formal event. And that's at the National Cathedral, the religious service at the National Cathedral. So Laura Trump wakes up, and she walks down the halls of the private quarters of the White House, and she says, can anybody else get their feet in their shoes? And she hears these screams coming from all over the White House, and it's the Trump women all saying, no, their feet are swollen from the high heels, and they've got one more day, one more event that they've got to get their feet into those high heels. And so they bring them buckets of ice-cold water, and they stick their feet in the ice-cold water to reduce the swelling so they can go out one more time and appear at one more event. On the way home from the inaugural religious service at the National Cathedral, Madonna, at that very moment when they're in the car caravan on their way back to the White House, the Secret Service alerts them that there's been a threat to their lives. And it's at that moment that Madonna has gone on stage and said, I've thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House. And so that message hops from one car to the next by text message. So it's interesting how they cope. And that's part, Joe, that's part of the book I enjoyed writing, was getting the inside scoop on the family and how they survive all of this.
Amen. Amen. Interesting. Anybody?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Paul.
No, Craig, it's fine. Go ahead. Thank you, Doug. It's such a pleasure to meet you and hear you. I would listen to a couple of interviews that you were involved in today, and the Lord's allowed you to have such rich experiences in your life. And I just like to hear your heart a little bit about how did you get interested in politics? First of all, if you could do this for me, if you could give me maybe your thoughts on a working definition of politics, if you could do that. And then if you could just share with us about how you got interested in it, and then we could go on from there. I have maybe some more questions. Okay.
I don't know if I am interested in it, but I'm sure involved in it. And politics is our people, and it's what you've got on your show in the studio. It's people right now, and you got to get along. But the way I got involved in politics and public life was very interesting. I'd read the Bible through three times, and I thought, what am I missing in my life that's in the Bible? And the most glaring thing I noticed that was continually all through the Bible that wasn't in my own life was the attitude toward the poor and taking care of the poor. And I saw that from the Old Testament all the way through the New Testament. It was there. I mean, when Peter and Paul, for example, Paul described his meeting with Peter in Jerusalem, and he said, they said, no, we don't have to be circumcised. They only said that we should, there's no fornication, and they said we should feed the poor. And of course we would do that. I thought, wow, of course I don't do that. And so from that, I launched Save the Refugees. I launched, became a founding board member of Mercy Corps. We've raised several billion dollars of food and delivered it around the world. And that's how I met the Carters, how I met the Fords, how I met the Reagans, and through them, the Bushes. And so that's where all that came from. And interestingly enough, in a way, that's how I met the Trumps, not through fundraising for the poor, but the Boko Haram, a terrorist organization in Africa, kidnapped these young ladies, and a few of them escaped. They came to the United States to get an education, and the FBI contacted me because of our school and said, can you take these Chibok girls? And I said, yes, I can, and we will. So we took the Chibok girls and gave them a home and got them scholarships, got them counseling, got them tutors, got them lawyers, legal representation. And so the night of the 2016 election, by then I'm out of politics. I'm I was with the Bushes. That's all past. I'm on the shelf. And I get a call from the BBC, and they want me on their major show in London. It's a morning show, but it's the middle of the night here in the U.S. I didn't want to do it. I said, oh, no, no. And then I don't know anybody in England. Who cares if I'm on? But they persisted, and they really wanted me. I said, okay. So in the middle of the night, I got up. I got dressed. Their car took me into downtown Washington, D.C. I did their show. And the BBC, they said, why is Donald Trump hiring his own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his own daughter, Ivanka Trump? That's illegal. I said, no, it's not illegal. They said, well, that's never happened. I said, yes, when Ivanka's hired by the White House, she'll be the 18th son or daughter of an American president to work in the White House for their father. But it hasn't happened since the Kennedys because they passed some law. No, that's not true. Susan Ford worked on the White House staff as a photographer. Chip Carter had his own office in the White House. He was on the payroll of the DNC. There are ways it can legally be done, and it is done. Yes, but she's a young lady, Ivanka. No daughter of a president has ever served in such a prominent position. I said, yes, they have. Anna Roosevelt, FDR's daughter, ran the White House her last year in FDR's last year in government. She planned the Yalta conference. Yes, it has happened. But why would they want their own children to work in there? Because, I said, Donald Trump will soon learn that the most important characteristic of a good staffer is loyalty, not competence, but loyalty. Chiefs of staff will come and go, but she will always be daughter, and she'll always have a seat at the table for Thanksgiving. So I went home that night. The car drove me home. I got back in my pajamas. I crawled back into bed, and I thought, well, I did the early morning BBC show in London, but nobody I know is watching. But I was wrong. Ivanka was watching. And she saw the show, and she sent me an email, and she said, thanks. And I wrote back and said, would you like to meet the Chibok girls that escaped from the Boko Haram? She said, yes. So I brought the girls in and met Ivanka and began a relationship. And from that came the book. So you ask how I got involved in politics. Mm-hmm. It all came from the Bible. It all came from helping the poor.
Terrific.
I love that. Serving others led to visibility, which then led to opportunity, right? Isn't that what we would all hope for in our careers, that you give to others and then it comes full circle to you?
Yeah, I guess so. It doesn't feel like it sometimes, but now looking back on retrospect, that's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah, I watched an interview that you were in with the Washington Journal, and I put myself in your shoes, and I don't know how you continue to remain smiling with non-questions and more commentary than that wasn't always positive. But you did a great job, by the way. So, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know that I can be wrong about things, so I don't want to get cocky. And I admire the way Jesus handled questions. Mm-hmm. And he used sarcasm. A lot of people get mad, don't like sarcasm. They think that's awful, but Jesus used sarcasm. Remember, he called the Samaritan woman a dog. So he was being sarcastic, unless you think she was really a dog.
That's right. Yeah. Anyone else?
Doug, I have another question, Doug. It must be awfully deflating sometimes to work in Washington establishment, but along the way, I'm sure you've met some people who've had some pretty great impacts on your life. Could you share with us perhaps who's had the greatest impact on your life and why?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I just have to say this, and this may be startling to some people, and they may not like it. Donald Trump is an extraordinary person. I worked in the White House, And we never would have let the president say and do the things that he says and he does. We would. They're so bold. It's just incredible. It reminds me of Sun Tzu, who some doubt this quote, but it's attributed to Sun Tzu, that out of chaos comes opportunity. Donald Trump blows up NATO, and the media just goes crazy. They're just angry. They say, this is America's oldest alliance. This is outrageous. And he blows it up, and then he rebuilds it. Because NATO was corrupt. They were using that money. They weren't keeping their word. They were signing a treaty and they didn't keep it. Our middle class were paying for high-speed railways in Germany and new airports in Italy and France, while they totally disregarded any money. 2%. We had asked them to pay 2% of their GDP on national defense. Can you believe that? Well, America has to spend billions, trillions to defend them. They wouldn't even spend 2% of their GDP, and our middle class is going bankrupt in this country. It's tragic. Well, he blew it up, and then he rebuilt it, and he raised $90 billion. Think of it. The wall with Mexico is $2.6 billion. He raised $90 billion from NATO. He blew up NAFTA. And all my conservative friends said, oh, this is terrible. He's not a real conservative. He's against free trade. Well, as he explained it to me, NAFTA was 17,000 pages long. Now, keep in mind, the Bible is 1,000 pages long. NAFTA was 17,000 pages long. It doesn't take 17,000 pages to write free trade. It was total corruption, page after page of corruption. And he blew it up and he rebuilt it with this new Mexico-Canada-US deal that all three countries like better and is more fair. He deregulated. It made the big monopolies angry. They couldn't stand it because it released the angels of free enterprise, of small businesses, the mom and pop shop. And what I learned working for 40 years with the Bushes is that in this country, the big monopolies are enhanced by regulation. They want regulation. They want environmental regulation. They want any kind of regulation. American Disabilities Act, they'll embrace anything. They favor special interests. Why? Because it adds to regulation, which adds to the cost of doing business, which they can afford, but you can't. So they want you. They want to get you out of business. And if you're not in business, they want to keep you out of business. So if you've got a ma-and-pa donut shop, they pass the American Disabilities Act. Now you got to spend $150,000 to build a new restroom inside that donut shop with handles and special. The idea, the name of the game is, and always has been, monopoly. Mm-hmm. And the thing I learned working for the Republican establishment is they're different companies they favor, but it's the same thing, is the stimulus bill, a stimulus bill. You know what that is? What happens is these big companies have all these regulations to keep the small businesses from starting up. Then once they get going, there's a recession. And when there's a recession, the government comes to the lobbyists and say, what can we do? We're good Democrats. We're good Republicans. What can we do to help you create jobs for our people? And the lobbyist will say, well, you know those regulations we just passed? We need about a 10-year hiatus where we don't have to keep any of those regulations. And then we can create some jobs for you. So they then get exempted from the regulations that you have to keep. They don't have to keep them. On top of that, they use the Import-Export Bank. On top of that, they use the Federal Reserve. McDonald's, for example, in 2008, got $130 million at 0% interest from the Federal Reserve. Didn't even go through a bank, went direct to the company. So they were able to refinance all their old debt, start all over again. You start a hamburger joint, you pay through the nose, and you have to know your tax dollars are going to subsidize your competition. So Donald Trump is hated by the monopolies because he freed up the regulations to allow small business to compete. There were many government contracts that Boeing had a complete monopoly on, and now they have 40 different competitors. That's what happened. And you'll notice when COVID-19 hit, what happened? They shut down everything but the monopolies. Walmart's still going, Costco's still going, Target's still going. They shut down. You can't go to church. So there you go. So I think Donald Trump is one of the most remarkable persons. He's taken on these sacred cows. I'll give you one more example that this wouldn't happen to anybody else that I know of. In Afghanistan, they went through the line item budget of the Afghan war with the Pentagon and the generals with the president. And he said, "What's this? This is the biggest item. What's this?" They said, "This is the salary of 200,000 Afghan soldiers. And why do we need them? Well, they're our army, Mr. President. But we pay them, we pay all their salaries, but they're our army. They go where we say, they train the way we ask them to train. You can't have it any better than that. You want American boys to do it, or you want the Afghan army to do it? But we pay this much money to the Afghan army? Yes, Mr. President, and that's a bargain, Mr. President. What's their names, sir? What's their names? Well, there's 200,000 soldiers, Mr. President. Well, give me a name of one of these soldiers. Okay, we'll do an audit, Mr. President. We'll audit the soldiers. We'll get right back to you." And they ran an audit, a computerized audit of the 200,000 soldiers in the Afghan army. And the first pass through, they found that 100,000 didn't exist. They were a ghost army. It was money going down a rat hole all through the last 6 years of George Bush's presidency, all 8 years of Barack Obama's presidency. We were paying billions of dollars in graft and corruption to people in Afghanistan, in America, in companies, in the United Nations. Donald Trump is an extraordinary person. And I think all through history, he's going to be seen that way. And actually, some of the more clownish and absurd things he says and has done is probably only going to attract more attention.
Wow. Go ahead.
I was doing some research on you, and I was on your website, and you have a couple videos that are thumbnailed up there. And one of them is on Fox News, and you were talking about when you realized or when you predicted that Hillary was not going to win. And one of the things that you commented on was that there was a lot of momentum and energy for Trump at his gatherings, and there wasn't that for Hillary. And I was wondering if you have any observations or thoughts on the upcoming election and where we're headed and why you believe that way.
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I know who I'm going to vote for. But I don't know what's going to happen. And it's heartbreaking for me as a student of history and as someone who's studied history all my life that we may have to experience socialism. It's a terrible thing. I've traveled all over the former Soviet Union and all over the world and seen socialism all over the world. And it's a terrible thing. It's a tragic thing. One of the lessons I learned in visiting the former Soviet Union is they didn't know what they didn't know. I would ask them, "Well, what books were you not allowed to read?" They'd say, "Well, we don't know. Name a book and I'll tell you if we could read it." "What movies couldn't you see?" "I don't know. Name a movie." And it was very different than I expected. What was prohibited and what wasn't prohibited. But entire sections of world history are just cut up and eliminated. And were eliminated in the Soviet Union. And that's what we look forward to in the United States if we tilt left, as it looks like it's very possible that could happen. It could be a tragic thing. If you read the lectures of Isaiah Berlin, he's the great socialist lecturer. He's not a writer, he gave speeches, but he's quoted by all of the great socialist writers. And he was once asked in one of the sessions, "Why do socialist countries and societies not allow free speech?" And it's true. No matter how well-intentioned they are, these socialist governments all over the world always has been the same. They eventually squelch and stop free speech. We're starting to see that in America. My book, for example, cannot be advertised on Twitter. It's published by the second largest publisher in the world, and Twitter will not allow it to be advertised because it's kind of pro-Trump. So I can't remember where I was going with that. I'm having a Biden moment. What was
I was asking you about the election, and you were just alluding to it might swing that way and your concern.
Yeah, and socialism and what socialism mm-hmm. might be like. And Isaiah Berlin. And Isaiah Berlin, I need a teleprompter, Joe. If I had a teleprompter, I'd in big letters, I'd have Isaiah Berlin up there. But anyway, Isaiah, but I'm not running for president, so there's a big difference. But Isaiah Berlin said that the reason there's not free speech is because the opinion of the individual should never trump the opinion of the collective. This is how socialism thinks. This is how Marxism thinks. That's why in the Soviet Union, a factory worker who outperformed the others would be disciplined and would get harsh discipline. So you could work too hard. You got to work in the middle. And it's why they don't have free speech, because the speech of an individual is not important and can be distracting. It's the community speech that's important. It's what the whole group decides on as a commune that's important. That's how Isaiah Berlin explained it. And that may be where we're headed, folks. It's the antithesis of Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Jesus said, the whole world is not worth a single soul. That's Christianity. The power of the individual, that the shepherd leaves the sheep and goes out there to find the lost sheep. That's Christianity, and that's part of the culture we've been raised in. And that's what's at stake this November.
Doug, do you think there's some value too? We did hear one individual share, one pundit, that he kind of looked at this like you're saying, that the coast, east side of America, pretty much we're finding a group of people who, you just made me think of this, who aren't really believing in Christianity at all. Basically, they're atheists, they're borderline socialists, anarchists. They're leading that direction. Their favorite revolution is not the American Revolution, based on religious freedom and bringing Christ, but the French Revolution. They even had in Portland, a guillotine in effigy. And they're saying that this particular, I think it was Victor David Hansen that was sharing, and he's like you guys are alike. And he did share that he felt possibly that Christianity and that part of America who believes in that is going to be polarized completely from this group heading towards socialism in the area of the French Revolution, and they're going that way. They will not hear, there will not be a blending. So, and I remember you said something once that you believe this may be the most important election that there's ever been, and you mentioned the Civil War, where, as powerful and strong as that was. Could you say just a word on that for us?
Yeah, I think it's an extremely important, I know Cold War was a defining moment in history, and the election of Ronald Reagan, that was important, that we communism was moving to, it was the age of communism. I mean, Henry Kissinger was picked up on a hot mic at a dinner in Montreal, Canada, telling a dinner guest at an embassy there that we're in the age of the Soviet Union. And there was that general feeling till Reagan came along, and it all turned around. Mm-hmm. And what Donald Trump has done, I described it once, Joe, as like being in a dark room and he's turned on the lights, and we look around and we see all these things in the room that we never saw before. Oh my goodness, we're looking at this stuff. And Joe Biden wins, the lights will go out again, but we'll never forget what we saw we know what's in the room. We know some of the corruption. We know some of the games that are played and how and why. We saw what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, and we can't forget what we saw. And I saw it in government back when when I was in government and in the White House in the 80s, Joe, I was in a Republican right-wing administration, new administration, that just took over from Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and someone in personnel at the White House came over to tell me that anybody who applied for a job in that White House and it said on their resume they were a graduate of Gordon Cornwall Theological Seminary, their application was dropped in the wastebasket. It didn't even go into the system. Now, that's a Republican right-wing administration in the 1980s. Wow. So you can get a feeling for how far we've come in the deep state. And liberals are attracted to Washington. They're attracted to bureaucracy. So you don't find many conservatives in there, in any of the departments, in any of the agencies. They aren't there. A conservative opens a new restaurant somewhere. It's a liberal. It's someone who believes that government has the solutions for people, who goes to Washington and gets a job and works in the bureaucracy. So no matter who is president, whoever goes in there, they inherit, as Donald Trump did, this massive deep state, and it has its own agenda. Wow.
Folks, we've got about two and a half minutes. Somebody have another question? Doug, thank you. That was a great response. Thank you very much. Anybody else?
You, Doug, you've been with Trump. Did you ever ask, or do you have a feeling what his idea for uniting America is?
You know, he's been at this his whole life. Ivanka told me and Don Jr. that they would, as little children, they were playing under his desk in Trump Tower, and he'd get the morning newspaper and he'd cut out parts in the paper and paste them on cardboard and put them in files in his filing cabinet. And he's been wanting to correct all this stuff all his life. I can tell you that he loves what's happened for African Americans. He's so proud of the fact that the jobs, that he's given them jobs. LBJ gave them food stamps, he says. They've got jobs with me. And he loves the fact that 20,000 African American young men were released from prison from nonviolent crimes. Many of the men on marijuana, three strikes and you're out, and they're serving almost life sentences. And he's proud of what he's happy for them. And I think left to his own devices, in another 4 years, America would come together if he's reelected.
Amen. Well, folks, Doug, we have to beat the clock. We're on the kind of program, you know how that thing, but this is so exciting. We could go on for hours. And I'm just so glad you got to meet these co-hosts. These are some of the most wonderful people in the world, Doug. And I guarantee
sure
are. They're going to be praying for you. They're going to be praying for the president, right, folks? We're going to be praying for all the folks who know now. This is the book right here, Inside Trump's White House, folks. You want to go and get your copy. And you don't just get facts, but you get wisdom. You don't just get information. You get years of experience. And you get things in this book that Doug has shared from his heart, from his mind, and from the real people that he writes about. So get your copy, Inside Trump's White House, right here, New York Times bestselling. And Doug, on behalf of everybody, thanks for being with us. And if any of you want to share or share a word about Doug on the program, just go to our website. You can go on the website, scroll down. You can speak to each of the folks that are co-hosts with me. You can get their website. You go to Stephanie's. You can find out how to get well. She'll take care of you at stephanwellness.com. She'll fix you up. And all of us are on there. And Doug, again, on behalf of everybody, thank you, sir. You're a national asset. You're an asset not only for the Lord, for everybody, but you're also an asset to everybody. Of all the folks that I knew, and I had the privilege of being just a principal for you, and you were the head of Canyonville Christian Academy, there wasn't a day go by that you didn't inspire me, sir, and you didn't inspire everybody on that staff. And the kids that have gone and grown up around the world, God used you to inspire and encourage. And we want you to know, right, folks, we're going to be praying for you and holding you up, and we'll look forward to talking to you again, sir.
Thank you, Joe. And if you're listening or watching this, send $10 to this show to defeat the censorship that's going on in this country. And let's keep this great group of people on the air.
Amen. Just go to the website, folks. There's the big button that says donate. And
good.
That'll be a good one. It's ready to go. It's greased. Set to go. All right. On behalf of everybody, God bless you, Doug. And
we'll
look forward to you next Monday night, 6 o'clock Pacific Standard, 8 o'clock Central Standard, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, raising expectations. We hope you're encouraged. We hope you're strengthened. And our prayers go with you. We'll see you next week, raising expectations.
Friends, thanks for joining us on this week's program of Raising Expectations. We profoundly hope you found it engaging and at times humorous, but most of all, uplifting, so that we may, with you, one topic at a time each week, become more encouraged to move forward to an exciting future in, as we always say, this thing called life in America today. So let not your hearts be troubled, your family, finances, faith, freedom. It can be a great future as we talk, listen, respect, and pull together. Please let me hear from you. You can reach me at 972-922-8556. That's 972-922-8556, or Joe Schofield on Facebook or LinkedIn. It'd be a pleasure to know you, and we hope you'll listen in again next week on the BBS Radio Network.